The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee.
Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating feature blend for the more adventurous of you out there. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy August, you movie-loving men and women, and thank you much for taking in the next 100 project. This week we've got a special episode that we're recording while on our cottage vacation. We're going crazy up there at the lake, you know. Where we talk about movies we hated, some of the worst films we've ever seen. We'll also answer some of your questions at the end of the podcast. We haven't done listener email in quite a long time, so we're way overdue. And in doing all of that, we will spoil more movies than you can shake 47 sticks at. I'm Ryan Ellis, and here's my wife and co-host, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, so I've got 10 pictures I want to insult, and Bev has 5 she wants to insult. So I guess I'll go 2 to her 1.
Yeah, I just have a lot of things to say about the movies that I hate. Some of them are movies that a lot of people really love, so I really have to rationalize it.
All right, I've got a little subsection each time. The first one I'm calling the Prestige Picture Failures. The first one is The Artist.
Oh.
L'Artiste.
Oh, The Artist.
For something so beloved, it's quite stupid, and it's one of the weakest Best Picture winners of all time.
The only thing it has going for it is that it's silent, so you and I, by the second half, maybe by like the last third, we're just actively making fun of it.
Masterpiece Theater 3000.
Yeah, it was just stupid.
Insulting to every character, I suppose, but especially the woman, was it Bernice Bejo, I think is her name?
Yeah, I think that's her.
She did as well as she could with it, but it was badly written. I don't remember some of the things I hate about these movies, by the way. My 10... I just know that I hated them at the time, so I'll apologize for that now by not having a lot of great missiles for my cannon shots.
I'll make up sense. For it. I have okay. Lots of missiles.
But I seem to have an agreement from you on that one. We watched that as a download. We didn't see it in the theater, so we could talk through it like you said. And I'm glad we had that opportunity because it was more fun to make fun of it than to watch it itself. And it was not surprising it won Best Picture, but it was a bad choice.
I heard someone say the only reason that it won Best Picture is that it wasn't just that the field was weak that year. It was more the field was divisive and it was the only movie that nobody hated. Well, clearly no one asked us. We saw that movie after all of the awards bodies recognized it as one of the best movies of the year. So our expectations were way too high. I often wonder if we would have been far more charmed by it if we went in with no expectations
at all.
In
the early fall, or whenever it first came out, late fall, whenever that was. And by the way, if you hear any snoring, that would be Sam. We don't usually let the dogs sit on the couches with us from home, but here we are in a cottage, and, well, the rules are a little more lax.
Yeah, and okay. He's fallen asleep and snoring on Ryan's lap right now.
The other film I hated in the Prestige section, I've mentioned this many times, this will surprise no one who listens to our podcast, Les Miserables.
Ugh.
The concept is stupid, and I hated most of the performances. I was sick of the movie 10 minutes in.
I was kind of okay with it until Fantine died, and then everything after that is so bad. But people loved it!
I know.
There's reaction videos of people in the car crying over how hard they felt that movie.
Anne Hathaway is by far the best thing in the movie, and I didn't think her character was all that, well, I guess it's necessary. But once she died, it didn't feel like the movie was really losing that much because it's really the whole battle between Russell Crowe and Hugh Jackman.
Well, I mean, her daughter, Cosette.
Right, yeah.
Right, that see, I'm he forgetting feels the responsible story line
already. Well, I really hated that movie. I'm so glad it didn't win any major awards like Best Picture, but it was up for Best Picture and I think a lot of other major ones. And of course, Hathaway did win the Supporting Actress Award. So that's my 2 in the Prestige Failure section. Now, Bev, your first of 5.
Okay, so I'm going to start with an easy one that I don't think is going to offend too many people. I hate He's Just Not That Into You. Hollywood turns out terrible rom-coms by the dozen. So in that respect, there's nothing special about He's Just Not That Into You. But what makes it criminally bad is that it's based on this excellent, hilarious, radical advice book written for single women that would totally apply to single men. And the film totally betrays that book in every way possible. The book, which was famously written by a couple of Sex and the City writers, a man and a woman, who had written an episode about all the ways women make excuses for the reasons men are ignoring them or their friends rather than just accepting that he's just not that into you and moving on to meet someone who is just that into you. Seems like a simple concept, I know, but I swear when that book came out, I was single, I was in my 30s, and it was exactly what I needed to hear. I never forgot the advice it gave, and I couldn't begin to calculate the hours I never wasted pursuing doomed one-sided relationships thanks to the simple, hilarious, and direct advice in that book. And then the movie starts by being true to the book, then loses its nerve and sells the whole thing out so that all the characters can have the happy ending. And all those guys really did love them the entire time. They just needed a kick in the head to realize that, no, you don't need to stop wasting time with someone who's clearly sending you red lights. You just need to pretend to move on, and then he'll totally realize how much he needs you and come around. I imagine that somewhere in the process, there was a version of the film that was thoughtful and faithful to the source material, but it just got beaten into submission by the studio system. But I really wish that somewhere in that process someone had just had the decency to change the title. Because I grieve for all the women and men who could have benefited from that message but got this derivative, gutless Hollywood crap instead. And as a bonus gripe, am I really supposed to believe that Jennifer Goodwin, the world's cutest human, can't get a date or is getting like stood up by dates?
I don't remember this movie all that well, but that's the part I remember the most. And she was new to me. I don't think I'd seen her in anything before that. She is so adorable. She's a pretty good actress, but that was absurd. And then the whole cast is good for that matter. It's one of those movies where they wasted a lot of great actors, women and men. So I guess we're 3 for 3. Neither of us liked any of the 3 movies we've picked so far.
Don't worry, I'm gonna disappoint you.
Okay, my next 2. Macho Crapola section this time. Bad Boys 2, which made me physically angry. I hated that movie so much. I have such a visceral memory of hating almost myself, really, for being there, and I should have walked out. I never walk out of movies. I was tempted. I heard 2 women behind me who were loving this sexist stupidity, and I could not believe that. Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, as much as everyone loves them together, and the first movie is adequate at best, I guess, but this one was just everything wrong with big-budget movies like that, and it was a monster hit, which is even more insulting. I just hated that movie.
By the time it came out, I had already learned better than to watch Michael Bay movies, so I have not seen it.
Well, The Rock and Armageddon are still pretty good, especially The Rock. But this was, I think, even worse than his Transformers movies. Just really unfunny, offensive stuff in that. Anyway, so let's move on to my 2nd in the Macho Crapola category. I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. The word comes up again, stupid. Also very sexist, unfunny, incredibly unbelievable reactions from the women towards the main character in this movie. It's based on this guy's life. So he can argue that this all really happened, and maybe some of it did, but it just comes across as such a crock, and so many things in it just made me say, what in the fuck is going on with this guy, and this movie for that matter? It's only been a few years since it came out. Most of my titles, by the way, are pretty recent. I could have picked a lot of movies from the old days. We could have picked more Top 100 Project movies, by the way, but none of them really rankled me the way that movies like I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell did. But you didn't even see that one, did you?
I know about Tucker Max, though, and I know that his whole brand is being offensive. The guy who's sexist, and I think he's racist too. Well, he's politically incorrect.
It's more about the sexism in that movie.
Yeah, I think I visited his blog based on a woman's recommendation just because she thought I would like its vulgar, daring humor. But it does remind me of a documentary we saw a few years ago called Deception, all about lying, where one of the press agents for the Tucker Max movie...
Oh, no, you mean Dishonesty, the Truth About Lies.
Yeah, okay, sorry, which I highly recommend. It's a great movie. The press agent talks about how they made up a protest. They invented women protesting the film just to get press.
Okay.
And it worked. The movie did better than it should have. Because, as you say, it was terrible.
I don't think it
got one good review.
I only saw it within the past year, and I still have forgotten a lot of things about it, but I do know that I loathe so much of it. And it's one of those movies, and I have another one I'm going to mention in a few minutes, but I kept on thinking, it's going to get better than this. It has to get better than this. And I didn't turn it off, and I should have, of course. But I don't turn off movies, like I said before. Okay, your 2 pick.
All right.
I guess you're counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I don't really have a top 10 list, per se.
No, I don't either. I had an order, but I'm actually going to switch my order up now to accommodate your Macho Crapola, because that is my main gripe with this movie that I know you like.
All right, well, I'm going to take a drink in honor of that.
I hate Glengarry Glen Ross. I hate it.
If I wanted to make a mess of this cottage, I would have done a spit take.
Okay, everyone loves the dialogue. I think it's overkill, it's forced, and it's phony. It never sheds its theaterness. I always feel like I'm watching a play. Every single character is despicable, and the macho-ness of it is just so much. The swearing, the posturing, Al Pacino describing his memory of great lays. Get the fuck out of here. I was pretty young when I watched the movie and I knew virtually nothing about it. Someone had recommended it to me. The moment Alec Baldwin pulls those brass balls out of the box. I honestly considered that whoever recommended the movie to me was just having me on. This is a terrible movie. I get it. I've been trying to find a way into this film, assuming it was smart and nuanced. But that was foolish. This is stupid. But people love it. It blows my mind. I will never understand the appeal of that Alec Baldwin speech. It's so... It's
a great speech.
No. As a villain, he makes Boris and Natasha seem subtle and nuanced. It's ridiculous. And it's just so testosterone-driven that I found it really alienating. And I don't typically struggle to get into macho films. I like my share of war films or sports films. Maybe the difference is that Glengarry Glen Ross is kind of working with the assumption that the audience will enjoy all the alpha posturing. That they want to be Alec Baldwin or Al Pacino or Kevin Spacey in this movie. Like, there's some fantasy fulfillment about being the guy who would rip off and manipulate customers or sell out poor, desperate Jack Lemmon. I couldn't access a single character in it.
You can't access Jack Lemmon, the inspiration for Gil in The Simpsons.
It's just pitiable. He's so pitiable.
He's fantastic in that movie.
He is fantastic. Okay, fair. Praise for the performances and the way that they say some of those lines with a straight face.
I'm a big fan of that movie, so I have little else to say other than that you're incorrect.
Well, you could please defend it.
I've always loved that movie from the very first time I saw it. Of course, it's over the top with the dialogue and the way that they speak, but that is very David Mamet for you, and it was based on his play.
Maybe I don't like David Mamet.
Maybe you don't. Maybe you should have directed it. James Foley, the guy who I think now is directing the 50 Shades movies at this point in his career, it was one of his first films. It wasn't his very first. I think he did an okay job, but he did put together a pretty great cast. I've seen that movie, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. I've liked it, maybe not more every time, but I've liked it every single time I've seen it. And I think Lemmon seems to get better every time I see it. It's like his performance blossoms and blooms even more. The Oscar winner that year was Al Pacino in a different movie, Sense of a Woman, and it should have been Denzel Washington and Malcolm X or Jack Lemmon in Glengarry Glen Ross. He wasn't even nominated. All right, let's move on from the Glengarry slamming. First disagreement we've had so far. Okay, then. Rom-coms that made me mad. And there's a lot more than these two, but I narrowed it down to these two pretty recent ones. The first one is 2003's How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. I hated Kate Hudson in that movie. I hated Matthew McConaughey in that movie. And I hated that fucking movie. It was so unbelievable that they both make a bet that she can make a guy ditch her because she acts like the cliched idiot. And he can make a woman stay with him, but not because of sex or because of those kinds of things, but because he's actually in love with her. When he can't be in love with her because he's faking it. The concept was absurd. They're decent actors, but they were not good in that film. And I hated it so much when I saw it. I'll never see it again.
I think it had a really terrible subplot at some point, too, with Zooey Deschanel.
I don't remember that.
I could be mixing up with any number of right. Terrible Kate Hudson rom-coms.
Only a couple years out from Almost Famous for her, too, and she really started looking like this person who was only going to do one thing, which was trying to be Julia Roberts. And Julia Roberts is one of the great rom-com actresses, but she was in her share of shitty movies, too. My other shitty rom-com is The Ugly Truth, which I probably hated even more than How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Gerard Butler and Katherine Heigl are awful together. He simply cannot do rom-coms. He did a few of them around this same time frame, and he stopped, thank God, because he's really bad at it.
He's deeply unlovable. They had no chemistry. It kind of reminded me of the same kind of sexism that, say, Philadelphia Story had, but didn't have the excuse of existing in the 40s. It's just so blatantly sexist. He's so mean to her. Mm. And she's such a better catch than her behavior implies.
But she's also an idiot, and she's also a klutz. And she's also somebody who should have no trouble finding men or basic happiness because she's got every single gift the character does. And then she's Katherine Heigl, one of the beauties. Most women that do these movies are at least good-looking, if not gorgeous. You have to maybe go with the fact that she struggles with men to make the concept work because otherwise there's no movie. You're not going to cast somebody who's unattractive because that's not how Hollywood usually works. But make me believe that that person is having trouble in the areas that she was. Or in other rom-coms like that. And so many times the movies like that come out, they fail badly. These two are just some of the better examples or worst examples of that.
One of the biggest challenges most rom-coms have is casting likable hero and heroine and then convincing the audience that they can't find love. It is a problem that all rom-coms have to overcome, but she... Ugh.
Your first choice was the same thing, where it's hard to believe that some of those people, but especially Jennifer Goodwin, would struggle to find love.
Although they actually do kind of draw her in a way where it's that she throws herself at men too much and she makes herself too available. That actually is a more believable thing than she's a klutz and she's obsessed with her job, which is also such a boring, lazy Hollywood cliche. Yep.
All right, number 3 for you.
Okay, I'm going to go with a movie that didn't just suck, but broke my heart a little bit. And it's actually 2 movies. It's The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions. These are one of the few examples of a sequel for me that was so bad kind of ruined the original for me, and I loved The Matrix so much. And when I saw Reloaded, I remember thinking, it's okay, they're gonna fix it in the third one. They're going somewhere with this. And then Revolutions was so bad. It was such nonsense. Like, where do I begin? It took all the things that I reluctantly forgave about the first film, like the weird BDSM costume design, cryptic philosophy 101 dialogue, the troublingly flexible rules of the Matrix world. They just doubled down on all of it, and then they added like 1,000 characters who were universally terrible. Mouse and Tank are the actual worst. Every moment I wasted watching their story play out in these films is a moment I will list as a lifelong regret on my deathbed.
Mouse and Tank are in the first movie.
Mouse? Am I thinking of the kid? The one who's like, hey, Neo, where are you going now, Neo? I'm your best friend, Neo. I'm going to follow you around.
Mouse is one of the ones that gets killed in the first movie, and then Tank never comes back.
I'm thinking of Kid. They just call him Kid.
Okay.
See? It bled into the first one and ruined the first one for me. Also, they ruin one of cinema's greatest villains, Agent Smith. He is methodical. He's relentless. He's not a weird, angry, rogue, malevolent force. And why can he go between the Matrix and Zion? That makes no fucking sense. I got so mad. And I think the Wachowskis really want to be these mind-blowing, modern, spiritual gurus taking storytelling to the next level, but these films are them trying and falling flat on their faces, and I cringe watching these actors try to make sense of that nonsense dialogue. I finally watched that architect scene enough times to realize that it's just total bullshit, and it's like they promised us answers and then just panicked and fudged it when the moment came. If I just talk and use a lot of nonsense, circular logic and words that people probably don't understand, they won't notice that I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And the ending is what exactly? Every character we care about is dead. The good computer programs won. But humanity is still trapped in the Matrix. But it's the good guys using their bodies as batteries. Was I supposed to root for every person on Earth to wake up in their goo pod and join the Zion drum circle? It's terrible. It was so deeply unsatisfying.
Maybe this wasn't such a thing in 2003 when it came out. And by the way, I've noticed that we've already had a few 2003 movies. We're going to have some more, I believe, in 2002 as well, that same time frame. But anyway, when that movie came out, this may not have been said. It certainly has been said since that maybe the whole version of The Matrix is phony. The whole thing about Agent Smith going into Zion...
That's Zion's part of the Matrix.
The real world. That's just part of the game.
But then put that in the movie.
I think they wanted to be cryptic. They also, by the way, are guilty of biting off more than they can chew. And they're also not as good at filmmakers as you want them to be. Bound was their first film. It was terrific. It was so unlike The Matrix by any measure. But most of the films they've made since have not been good at all. They shoot for the stars and they maybe get as far as the top of your house.
Except in the first Matrix. That's a great way to say it, yeah.
But I do like the sequels more than you and a lot of other people do. I'm not going to defend that as strong as I would Glengarry Glen Ross, because I think that is a great movie, and those are not. But there's some good things in the sequels, and we do own them. I bought them a long time ago, but they were cheap. I didn't pay full freight for them.
It's my theory that the Wachowskis fell victim to what I call, and what longtime listeners are surely familiar with, the George Lucas syndrome.
Oh, probably.
Which is that they made something amazing and were perhaps unfairly given absolute credit for it, negating all the people behind the scenes that were massaging, supervising, providing constructive criticism. Maybe the Wachowskis kind of believed every word of this praise and thought that they knew better than every script doctor, producer, costume designer, well-meaning friend, anyone who challenged their view. And like George Lucas, they were heralded as special effects gods, right? And got really wrapped up in that aspect, ignoring that special effects are really only best when they're aiding a good story.
That the story is better than you thought it was, the screenplay. That's actually true of the first Matrix, very much so. The screenplay is not the greatest. The story is very good.
Yeah, the dialogue. And actually, that's true in Bound. Bound has some pretty bad dialogue in it, but you forgive it because the story is great. It's really engaging.
And Gina Gershon, for that matter. Tilly is fantastic in that movie.
That's maybe the best thing she's ever done. Mm.
So let's move on then. My seventh and eighth movies. This section's the horrendously idiotic executions of their premise. Meaning the premise is pretty good, but they failed so badly at actually presenting it in the movie. So John Q, another early 2000s movie. Denzel's character belongs in jail for a very long time when it's over. Not just a little while like he gets. When that movie was ending and they have the whole sequence that announces how long he's going to spend in jail, I think it's just a couple of years. I was literally saying out loud, not yelling it, but just about maybe this level, that kind of level. Life sentence, life sentence. He put all those people in danger. I don't remember if anybody got killed. Again, I haven't seen the movie in a long time. But it's one of those things where the guy did awful things. Almost terror attack is what he pulled off there. Sick son. Hey, I'm sorry to say your son has problems with the medical community. He was going to dive in and get a heart. But fuck you. It was for the right reasons, but you're still a sorry criminal, Denzel Washington's character. And that movie, by the way, IMDb, I looked it up just this afternoon, 7.1 out of 10.
Okay, but did you like the movie up until the very end?
No.
Was it that ruined it? No, you're like, it wasn't a good enough movie.
As and it's then it playing out, ending. I was liking it less and less. There's also a sequence where I think it's Ray Liotta's character says to Robert Duvall, I think it is, they're both playing cops, we got to make sure he's going to be okay. We can't just take him out. And then I think it's maybe 40 seconds later, we got to take him out. He contradicts himself in one scene. Not Liotta's fault, but the screenwriter's. Terrible movie.
So much bad writing in Hollywood.
My other one, and again, it's unbelievable the way they executed a premise that I might have been able to buy into. Lars and the Real Girl.
Oh yeah, you hate this.
The blow-up doll movie. When people go along with the concept of this guy's in love with this doll like it's actually real, I would buy that to a degree, but then they say that they take her, I forget the character's name now, the doll, take her out with them on the town like you would if they were going to go grocery shopping or antiquing or to the bar, whatever it is. And they actually do it and they play off like this thing is real. And I thought, I don't buy it. It's fucking stupid. The man's got a problem, obviously. But that's fine. A movie can present that. But don't present that everyone else buys into this delusion unless you have a movie that's all about them being insane, which is not what they were doing at all.
And then I also have a problem with the fact that somebody who is that clearly troubled gets the girl at the end. That there's a girl in the world who's like, oh, no, no, I'll totally date that guy that thinks this doll is real, may or may not be having sex with this inanimate object. And, oh, and the whole town knows it? Yeah, yeah, no, I'm totally down with that. I'll date him.
But for them to buy into this delusion,
oh, it's so
for his
stupid.
Sake,
yeah.
When he's not around.
I like the movie a lot better than you did.
When
I,
he's around,
I forgave it a lot.
That's one thing. But when he's not around, why are they buying
the
into
movie
it?
Is about
badly executed.
How it takes a village to help somebody who's troubled. It's all about how they, instead of reacting how most people would react to mental illness, they embrace him and they try their best to make him better. And I think they're following the advice of a shrink or something when they're doing it.
Okay.
So I bought it more than you did, but there's definitely points where it just goes too far and it's too hard to believe.
I really hated it. All right, you're number four.
All right, number four. This goes with your theme, bad concepts. You're not going to like this one. It's Ratatouille. I hate Ratatouille. I will begin with...
I like the movie, by the way. I'm not the biggest fan
no,
of it.
No, no, you're not.
Critics loved it way more than I did.
People loved it.
I liked it.
I'll begin with the admission that I have a cold, dead heart, and it is rare that I can enjoy any children's movie on any level, unless it's one of the all-time greats, like Toy Story. Yes, that includes movies that I loved when I was a child, because I have a cold, dead heart. But Ratatouille was just getting heaped with praise, and Pixar was hitting one after another out of the park, so I was optimistic, and I gave it a shot. On top of my distaste for kid flicks, I also have some pretty suspect opinions about foodism. I love good food. I love going to nice restaurants, but I find food culture repulsively snobby. And Ratatouille seems to try to get around that a little with the whole everybody can cook thing, but it's undermined by the fact that Remy can't cook, no matter how bad he wants to be good at cooking. All that aside, my real problem with Ratatouille was the way it completely failed to suspend my disbelief. The premise of a rat controlling a person like a marionette because a rat has some obsessive urge to cook for humans? It was just too labored, and then it felt stupid. I could never buy into it. And also, what is to like about Remy? He's untalented, charmless, but he gets the restaurant and the girl at the end. I honest to God have a near irrational hate for kids' movies. They have to transcend for me to get past all the cliches and hand-holding and formula following. I've actually been thinking hard about this week, trying to get to the bottom of it, because I seriously feel like I'm the only killjoy in the world who just can't find it for, like, Minions.
A lot of people hate Minions.
Okay, thank God.
A lot of adults hate Minions, at least.
You know what? And you know this. What I don't like, but everybody loves, is Baby Groot. I don't get it.
I like the Baby Groot thing.
Everybody likes Baby Groot.
Both baby and adult Groot.
I am not a Baby Groot fan. So there you have it. Send your angry letters to Ryan Ellis at top100project.com.
Well, of those three things, I think Groot's great. I think the Minions are pretty stupid. They're fine in the Despicable Me movies, but I don't remember them that much. They didn't stand out in my mind. I saw Minions, don't remember anything about it. But the middle ground with those characters you're mentioning would be the Ratatouille rat. I like the movie more than you, as I said earlier, but the concept I had a hard time getting past is that it's a rat in the kitchen. Regardless of how clean it supposedly is, it's still a rat. No matter how talented.
Although they kind of play with that. A rat in the kitchen. Like, that bothered me less than the marionette thing. And it made me mad. This does not pass for a good script. And there's still quite a bit of love for Ratatouille.
Some people put it at the top of their Pixar list. I've seen that. They're near the top of their list of Pixar films. That's saying a lot. There is that great sequence, that Peter O'Toole speech where he talks about what it's like to be a critic. And it's probably a bit of a jab by Brad Bird at critics, but also a loving embrace of critics in a way, too. And I've watched that sequence on YouTube more than once. It's a pretty good scene. Okay, so my last two. Go ahead, take a drink, Bev. Don't have to stop.
Oh, okay. I was trying to pause, but...
All right, well, I had no reason to pair these two. I just didn't like them, and they were my last two of 10. So, Dreamcatcher, another 2003 title. I held my pee for over 2 hours for that. And I've often said that Morgan Freeman has been in a lot of bad films, and certainly more so than when he made this movie 14 years ago. But he himself was never bad. Well, in this case, he was.
I read the book. I never saw the movie, but I remember thinking that was bizarre casting.
It's just a shitty, stupid movie. And shitty, of course, is a bad pun because they shit the aliens out their asses.
In the book, it doesn't seem that ridiculous. But that's just the way that Stephen King can make the most absurd things seem believable.
Most of Stephen King's adaptations have been pretty bad. And The Shining, Stand By Me, Shawshank, or some of the outliers, Green Mile as well. Although most of those aren't really bona fide horror, apart from The Shining. And Carrie's another one. But I just mentioned, what, 5 movies? And are even half of those horror movies? Even though that's his thing, the movie adaptations are better when they're not the horror movies. He's been adapted by many people. And I looked at my list of my least favorite movies of the year, my hated movies every single year. I didn't bother putting them in this, but Graveyard Shift was a book that he wrote. They made a movie of that. That was my least favorite movie in, I think, 1990. So more than once, he made a movie.
Of Graveyard Shift? Because I read Graveyard Shift, and I remember a movie coming out of
I saw it. And more than once, they made a movie of his books that were terrible. All right, my last one... Spun.
What's Spun?
That's the Jason Schwartzman drug movie. Came out in, I think, 2003 yet again, or 2002, one of those. It ruined me from liking Jason Schwartzman for a very long time, which I know isn't fair, but I hated him for a while, and I think it's partly because of that. I also didn't really like Rushmore the way everyone else did, but Spun was just me wanting to grip him through the screen and choke that little fucker.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there's no other comments on the film? It's just that it's...
Most of mine have been short explanations for why I hated them. And I think the reason why is because most of them were so long ago, I never saw them a second time. And it's visceral. The Bad Boys 2 thing in the theater. Spun. Dreamcatcher. I can picture myself sitting there and thinking, what in the fuck am I doing watching this? But I don't leave movies. I'm done with my 10.
So this is the main event. And actually, this won't be a secret to a lot of people who listen to the podcast.
You have mentioned
regularly.
This in the podcast before, yeah.
I fucking hate... Love Actually. If you love Love Actually, I am not sorry for ruining it for you. I hope I ruin this film for everybody. Because, and I say this because I care, Love Actually is a terrible movie. It has a bad script, it makes no sense, and is only good at plugging in formulaic music and pacing to convince our lazy brains that the character's behavior makes any sense. It is not only bad, it's mean. It's mean-spirited, and it has a bizarrely illogical take on romance. There's no attempt to accurately portray one thing in this film, whether it's a film set or a recording studio or a human relationship. There's zero effort to create verisimilitude. And it's not like they're portraying a turn-of-the-century haberdashery where one is not likely to have first-hand experience. They're portraying an office party or a friendship. I have a friendship, so I know it's weird for a friend to say, chastise you for failing to man up and get over your wife who died just a few weeks ago. Or dramatically profess love for your new wife on your front step while you're in the next room. People in this film don't act like humans. Their writing is so lazy. I could honestly write volumes on all the ways each and every subplot in this film is insulting garbage. But I have a few specific gripes that I will force myself to focus on. The Prime Minister and his fat crush.
Yeah.
She's like a size 8. You wrote a storyline about a fat woman and you forgot to cast someone who's actually fat.
She's adorable.
But even if she was a size 80, people do not talk about other people's weight this much. Virtually no one refers to her without remarking that she's chubby or has sizable thighs. And it's not just her sadist co-workers, her family! They're so mean! Why? People don't do that. And then he has this crush on her, so he fires her, which is illegal, but it's also remarkably selfish and cruel. It's not her fault that you get a fucking semi every time she walks into a room, Prime Minister. But I'm actually more offended by the scene where Hugh Grant somehow forgets that he's in a home with a staff and has himself an embarrassing dance party before sheepishly getting busted by his crush. Hey, Richard Curtis. Fuck you. That is a ripoff of every sitcom in history. You're a bad writer. I was so mad when I saw that scene. Also, me mum's dead.
That's favorite part of the movie. I should say least favorite, but hate this one.
So there's this scene where Liam Neeson, whose wife just died, is trying to talk to her son. And it's been weeks, as I understand. I see you're acting sad. It's probably because your mom's dead. And he's like, it's not because my mom's dead. It's because I'm in love. You're fucking 8.
She said this made that before. It's still funny.
If your wife died and her prepubescent son is more sad about a hot girl that doesn't give him the time of day than he is about his dead mom, he's not romantic. He's a sociopath. Run! Go into witness protection! Oh, and just one more quick thing. The Laura Linney plot. Why does she get fucked over so bad? She does everything right! Hugh Grant fires his crush and still gets a happy ending. What the hell? She gets one phone call from her mentally ill brother, and because she's a good person, she takes it, and her crush is like, I'm out of here. Oh my god, she has a brother who calls her on the phone. No, too much baggage for me. And I wish I could say that I was charmed by one of the equally absurd but slightly less offensive subplots, like the porn stand-ins or Bill Nye's shitty press tour, but you don't swallow a shit sandwich because someone put Miracle Whip on it. If you like Love Actually, stop. Stop liking it. Stop helping it climb up the pantheon of classic movies.
It is beloved.
There's like 4 plot lines where the only conflict is that someone's in love with somebody and they just don't fucking talk to them. Mm-hmm. They don't open their mouths and not tell them they love them. They don't speak to them. It's bizarre.
Well, you didn't specifically point out, you sort of did mention it, but the Andrew Lincoln sequence with Keira Knightley, yeah, which is cute but also absurd and really the wrong thing to do. If you're in love with your friend's now wife, then either cheat on her against him like normal people do, or shut your fucking mouth because you didn't speak up at the wedding when you could have been saying, no, I love her, actually.
That scene's been pilloried by better people than me, but he's a creep. He's a total creep.
It's a terrible thing to do.
He doesn't speak to her. She's like, he won't say one word to me. I think he hates me. Right. But then he's like following her around with the camera, being a total weirdo, and still can't even speak to her to profess his love. He has to like write it in cards and show her. And this is a thing that happens in the movie over and over again. People act wildly inappropriately and then get the girl. Now, he doesn't get her, but she, like, chases him down the street and gives him a big kiss. And then goes back to her husband.
Moment.
Yeah, he had his little moment where she's like, no, I totally like you too now for some fucking reason. Even though you're a huge weirdo and an asshole, a bad friend. That storyline, probably more believable, I guess. Except for the part where she then is thoroughly flattered by his attentions.
And then Colin Firth falls in love with his maid, who he really never speaks to because he doesn't speak Portuguese. He learns some of it.
And they make all these hilarious jokes about how when he's trying to chase after her and propose marriage to her out of nowhere, and they misunderstand because there are a bunch of Portuguese people living in France, and they think he's trying to purchase her as a slave. And then another hilarious joke where her father tries to offer him her sister instead, but she's fat, get out of here. Why would he want that?
No
Why would you want
fat
that
people
person?
Ever find love. This is not the Love Actually podcast, so let's move on.
Listen, you don't even know what I'm stopping myself from saying. I could write volumes.
It's the one movie I knew that would make this list. And if I can find it, by the way, I will try to find the link to Lindy West's hilarious article about this quite a few years ago, I guess, where she just lambasted the movie way worse than you did.
If there's one good thing coming out of the movie Love Actually existing, it's Lindy West's hysterical review of everything that's wrong with it. She wrote a line that God, it's so funny when the Prime Minister and his crush are in a car and there's a kid in an octopus costume between them and she calls him the cock blocktopus. It's all worth it.
So that was my 10 and that was Bev's 5, but some dishonorable mentions. I want to just get through these really quickly. The Most Dangerous Game, a movie that was made in the 30s. Great concept, disappointing execution, which I guess is a theme I already had before. A movie about where you hunt people. It wasn't really done all that well. But I remember thinking the movie had such potential and they really got to remake it. When I went through my list of movies I hated from every year, well, it's more so about my top 10 lists, and I just have a ranking of every movie I've ever seen because I'm that anal retentive. But at one point, many years ago, I did my top 10 for each year and I did my bottom 5 or 10 for each year. A lot of those movies I could have mentioned right now, but some of the ones I had in the 80s, which I didn't want to mention as movies I hated because maybe it's just they're quaint now. They feel like they are, really. I've seen the Rambo sequels and I don't hate them as much as I did when I ranked them the worst of their years. Friday the 13th sequel, some of those were the worst movies I'd seen those years. They're kind of quaint. And then the Jaws sequels, which originally were in my bottom 10 there, but I took those out for spun.
There's some movies that are meant to be stupid, so you forgive it. When your expectations match that, you're just not as bothered by it.
I guess so, and seeing them on Netflix or on demand somewhere in the last several years, all of those movies I mentioned, except for the Jaws sequels. And I mean 3 and 4. 2 is pretty good. We own 2, but 3 and 4 are really quite bad. But I've never seen them, either of them, a second time. I have seen the Rambo sequels and the Friday the 13th series in its entirety, I think, twice through. And as I say, I don't hate them as much as I used to. The movie series, meaning disaster movie, epic movie, date movie. I don't remember them, but in looking at my old files, every single time I put dud. So they must have been remarkably unfunny. And that's the other theme. You gotta hate completely inept and unscary horror movies or completely inept and unfunny comedies. The Last Summer movie certainly fit into that horror movie trope with some bad acting as well. What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? But I will watch horror movies more than any other genre, so I've seen a lot of really bad ones. And that is my dishonorable mentions section. All right, well, the emails then. We've got 7. Some of these are quite old now, but let's finally answer some of this stuff publicly, at least. Maybe we did in a private message to these people. So Scott asked if we've seen Tickled, and he also recommended we watch Under the Sun, which we will eventually. It is on Netflix. Tickled, the documentary about guys who like to be tickled. It's not really about that, is it?
Yeah.
And this, so yes, we have seen it, and I don't want to spoil it for people because it's an unusual film, and it's pretty damn good. Good documentary.
It really goes in a direction that you're not expecting, and it's just a look into something that I've never seen before.
I'd never heard of that kind of thing before. I didn't know people like to be tickled and will pay to get it done to them. I hate being tickled. I am not that ticklish, but I'm ticklish enough.
We've heard of fetishes. We know there are things that people are into that seem strange and kind of hard to wrap your head around, but that's just like the tip of the iceberg of that film.
Yeah.
We also recommend it, so good recommendation, Scott.
Tori wants to know our thoughts on The Grey. That's the Liam Neeson movie where the wolves hunt all those guys. And spoiler alert, everybody but him gets killed in their party. And then at the very end of the movie, is he dead? Did he beat the last wolf? Is the ending cool? They don't know for sure who survived between him and that wolf. Or is it a tease? I'm going to go with cool, I guess, because most movies don't end that way.
Did the movie earn it? I haven't seen it, for the record. Mm. It reminds me, though, the description of All is Lost, with a pretty ambiguous ending that I think the movie really earns.
Yeah. I think All is Lost, by the way, that he is dead and he's imagining that. I hope so. I don't want that movie to end with him being rescued.
When it ended, I was super relieved because I was like, oh, he was rescued at the last minute. That's amazing. And then like 5 minutes later, I'm over the fridge or whatever. Having my refrigerator moment. Wait a minute. Oh, shit, he's dead. But I could not recommend that movie highly enough. I thought it was so smart.
Tori has an issue with wild animals and being hunted by them. I don't worry about that kind of thing. And we are in the country right now, so I guess we have to give that some kind of thought if we go outside late tonight to let the dogs out for their evening pee, for example. But
when I was younger, I used to love Jack London books. White Fang opens with wolves stalking a group of people, and I think they succeed in the end. I think they kill all the people, but you're rooting for the wolves in that book, so.
And our wild animal Sam is enjoying this part.
If you hear panting or lip smacking, it's our super wild shih tzu over here.
It's ironic, we're in a better sound-controlled environment. This cottage is pretty good for it. It's raining, and you can't even hear it.
Mm.
In our room at home, you would hear it, but we don't usually let the dogs on the couch at home, and now we've done that.
We're also recording on an iPhone instead of our regular microphone. That is true.
Okay, Clifford is a huge fan of Oliver, and if we covered it, it would have to be next February, realistically, because that's when it would be 50 years old, in 2018. And we could do it in February for the Oscar month, is what I'm saying. But it's doubtful because we have other Oscar plans for movies that have anniversaries. I don't really remember Oliver all that well.
Is it the musical?
Yeah, the musical in 1968. But I don't remember it all that well. I don't really want to see it, but I'm glad he likes it.
I'll fight for it. I love musicals, so.
I guess we could give it a try. But we're planning to do 3 other movies plus our typical Oscars preview show in February of 2018. David is hooked on our podcast like a drug. Thank you.
Thanks,
and
David.
He thinks the ending of Double Indemnity was added after Billy Wilder ditched the original. He was correcting us in our podcast. I guess we had not said that that ending was added later. So he could be right. They changed that because I know it was supposed to end in the execution chamber and then Keyes would have watched his buddy go off to die. But they smartly ended it with a little love story between those two guys in the doorway of the office where it belongs anyway.
And where he might still be executed. He is going to jail at the very least.
Or dying from the gunshot.
Right, right.
He somehow survived long enough to tell his whole story to the dictaphone and not actually be dead of blood loss. But anyway, thanks, David, for being hooked on our podcast. Eve, she wants to know our thoughts about Clueless, which I've seen once, maybe twice. I think it's fine. I'm not a huge fan of it. What about you?
I don't think I ever loved it quite as much as a lot of other girls my age did, but I really enjoyed it, and I feel like it's aged really well. There's certainly films like that that I've thought of suggesting for the podcast, like that, or like Heather's movies that really were aimed towards teen girls, but teen girl movies very rarely get any positive attention from critics. They're always treated like they're stupid, but Clueless has really endured. I think there's probably tons of interesting things to talk about with Clueless. It is a far smarter movie than it looks, much like, what's her name, Cher is the lead character? Mm-hmm. Much like Cher, there's a lot more depth than the surface would imply.
Alicia Silverstone should have had a great career coming out of that and some other things. She was in Batman, really didn't do that much. She seems to have, if not quit the business, just take some kind of break, or maybe she doesn't get cast anymore.
Yeah, and Stacey Dash is a crazy person
right.
now.
Yeah. Wasn't Paul Rudd her stepbrother in that film?
Or am I thinking Cher's something else? Stepbrother is yeah, Paul
was.
Rudd. Yep,
so it wasn't his first movie, but one of his first big roles.
All three of the girl stars in it have strange... Well, Alicia Silverstone made out best of the three of them, obviously.
Mm. All right, so that's Clueless. Minor thoughts on that. Akeel 2000 asked what we thought about Hateful Eight in comparison to Reservoir Dogs and how they are so similar, and they certainly are.
Well, I just rewatched Hateful Eight, hoping, I think, that I would like it better on the second time around, which I really think was true about Death Proof, that I liked it a lot better the second time I watched it, but it does not hold up to the second viewing. I really think Hateful Eight isn't as smart as it should be and just winds up being an excuse for a bunch of really gory violence, whereas Reservoir Dogs is a masterpiece that holds up amazingly well after all these years, after decades. It's just a far better film, and maybe Quentin Tarantino is starting to suffer from a little George Lucas syndrome himself. Pains me to say, because I really, really love Quentin Tarantino. And I think even bad Quentin Tarantino is still entertaining. The language is just so delightful. You sink your teeth into these performances, and the visuals and the blood and the gore and everything about it is fun. Yeah, some surprises in it. But ultimately, Hateful Eight left me cold, whereas Reservoir Dogs still resonates all these years later. So I think Reservoir Dogs is just a better movie.
Tarantino has said he will not make movies until he's an old man because he thinks that that's when guys start making Drek. And he's not quite at that stage yet. He's not old either, but he's talking about quitting around this time of his life. I think we're talking the next few years. He said this quite a few years ago, so we'll see if he's consistent about that and actually does retire and go into book writing, which I guess is what he wants to do.
His last few movies have had diminishing returns. Okay. They have bigger budgets, bigger ambitions, and are kind of getting less satisfying. I didn't love Django. That was another one that didn't hold up on the second. I mean, I loved Django. It was fun, but just didn't hold up for me. And he's making now a movie about
Charles Manson.
Charles Manson, yeah. So I'm tempering my expectations now, which is the first time I think I can ever say that about Tarantino.
I haven't seen Hateful Eight a second time, and I want to. It's still on demand, and I really should check it out because I would be better equipped to answer this question. But I liked it plenty when I saw it the first time, not as much as his other films, granted. But we did get to see it in 70mm, and that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks great. It's a beautiful film. Mm-hmm. And I can never talk enough about how much I love Jennifer Jason Leigh's performance in that film. I am so glad she got nominated for Best Supporting Actress. I found it's just so radical and amazing, and I love the movie just for that above anything else.
And good casting. Kurt Russell, of course, in the movie. And
oh, yeah.
Great actress pretty much across
amazing.
The board. Yeah. All right, last one. Teddy just recently sent us a terrific message and asked if we're thinking about covering the Sight and Sound list. Well, Teddy, we have covered quite a few of those through our various iterations of the podcast, and we'll no doubt cover more of them. Specifically the Sight and Sound? Probably not, but I think we're going to end up covering most of them anyway. Tokyo Story was the one that took the top spot on either the critics or directors list. I forget which one it was now. And we've talked about that here and there through the podcast, but haven't done an actual podcast about it. Maybe we should. But we've done most of the other ones. Vertigo and Citizen Kane have been at the top of the list many times.
I think Teddy mentioned this in his message, that part of our discouragement with doing the Sight and Sound list, they're just not going to be popular. The more foreign and obscure our movies get, the less popular our podcasts are. The demand really is for more American films. That's what people like to see. Honestly, you and I know a lot about Hollywood movies, but I feel like when I really get out into foreign films, like Tokyo Story or a lot of films on the list, I have to be honest, I've never even heard of. And I wouldn't feel like I'm qualified to speak on them. Like, I don't know the context of them.
Well, that's what our research is for, though.
What's that?
That's what our research is for,
That is what our research is for. And it's actually, like, a good reason to do the Sight and Sound list, because it's a great resource of a list of movies that we should watch. As film lovers, we should be watching these movies
and talking about them. Well, we have referenced the Sight and Sound list more often than not when a movie was on, especially if it's in the top 10 of that list, at least. So in that way, we are covering the list, but just not specifically saying we'll do 10, and then 9, and then 8, and then 7, and so on. And of course, we can't anyway, because we have covered so many of them already anyway. But a good suggestion from Teddy, and we thank all of you for your emails. We'll close the mailbag, but I will say this before we end the podcast. Thanks for correcting us when we get our facts wrong, like I may have about the end of Double Indemnity. I don't think we are wrong very often, but we appreciate it when people set us straight, not offended, unless you're wrong in saying that we're wrong. We've deliberately made some rough edits in the podcast simply to cut out factual errors.
Yeah, we do really care a lot about that stuff. And we do care a lot about hearing from you guys. I know we say it in every episode and it may sound like lip service, but I cannot describe the delight that we get when we hear from you, even if it's to correct us or, you know, to disagree with us. Actually, I love it when people disagree with me and we can have a nice rousing argument about it.
That's better than agreeing all the time. That's dull.
Oh, no, no. Tell me I'm great. Please, tell me I'm right. I love that, too.
Rip into us for our choices today about our worst movies. And God knows, if I went through my list, I could probably find another 10 I hated as much as, if not more than the ones I chose to rip on today.
I could probably find some even more beloved movies to make people hate me.
Yeah. So top100project.com. Tweet us. She is at BevEllisEllis. I am at MovieFiend51.
Top100projectpodcast@gmail.com if you want to just message us privately. Mm-hmm.
And our website, of course, is top100project, even though we haven't done the Top 100 Project for more than a year and a half. Those are how to reach us. The coming attraction trivia for next week's picture, In Cold Blood. What version of Robert Blake frightens you the most? As Perry in In Cold Blood? As the mystery man in Lost Highway? Or as a real-life Murdiddlyardler?
All right, so for the answer to that, tune in next week. And we already gave you all of our contact info, so in the meantime, drink some spark plug coffee and cut!
Let's get back to drinking some booze at the cottage. Couple more days! See ya! Worst movies, terrible. Don't watch them. Never watch those movies.